Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook, and today we're talking about rituals of ethnicity, Tangmi Identities Between Nepal and India by Sarah Schneiderman. Sarah Schneiderman is a faculty member in the Department of Anthropology and the Institute of Asian Research at the University of British Columbia, and the book is published by Penn. Rituals of Ethnicity is the first comprehensive ethnography of the Tangmi, a Himalayan community who moved between Nepal, India, and the Tibetan Autonomous Region of China. Through a careful and rich analysis of orality, funerary rituals, the practices of gurus, and circular migration, to name just a few of the topics covered, the book makes a forceful case for ethnicity as something people do rather than are, and looks into how such performances of ethnicity speak to questions of citizenship and belonging across national borders. I had the pleasure of speaking with Sarah just a few moments before. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Sarah to the show. Thanks a lot for coming on, and thanks a lot for your wonderful book.
Thank you.
So I really enjoyed reading this because I found out about a community which I previously knew nothing about, and also the really wonderfully, carefully constructed and compelling argument about ethnicity as something that people do rather than simply are. But before we get to speak about the Tangmi, which is the subject of your book, this is a community of around 40,000 who live in the Himalayan region between India, Tibet and China and Nepal. Could you start by telling us what brought you to research amongst this community?
Well, thanks. First of all, thank you very much for having me. And I'm glad to have this opportunity to talk about the work. Yeah, I had been working in Nepal for several years already when in late 1997, I met Mark Turin, the linguist and anthropologist who later became my husband. And he had already started doing PhD research on the Tangmi language. We actually met in another part of Nepal where we had both previously worked further west. And he said, you really should come along with me and see what the environment is like, because this is a community, the Tangmi, who speak their own language, who maintain their own cultural traditions, and yet very few people seem to know about them, and they seem to have very little profile ethnographically or politically. So come on let's go and learn about them together. And so, of course, that was an invitation that I couldn't refuse. So we set off to the areas of central eastern Nepal in Dolakha and Sindhu Palchok districts, which are the heart of the Tangmi settlement area in Nepal. And I was just amazed at the experience because, as I said, I had already by that time spent several years in Nepal, but I had never been in a cultural environment like this one. People were speaking their own language fluently and seem to have a whole world of cultural practice and ritual, which really was not something that was accessible through existing anthropological or other kinds of materials. I came back from that trip and looked through all of the bookstores and libraries in Kathmandu that I was familiar with and could find almost nothing written about this community. So that sparked my curiosity, as had the fact that during my time there, many people from the community said to me, hey, you're an anthropologist. Why are you working somewhere else in Nepal? We actually really need an anthropologist. And we know that we're missing the ethnography about us. This is an issue for us politically. This is how some of the younger members of the community who were already involved in political activism were thinking. So I basically left from that first visit with an invitation to come back and learn more. And that's how it all began. I had not yet started graduate studies at that point. And then I ended up having a year-long Fulbright fellowship before I began my PhD program. And that's when I was really able to begin understanding ethnographically what I found there. And again, this was in Nepal, in Dolaka and Sindhu Palchok districts. But the longer I spent there, the more I realized that what I was missing in the story was the fact that so many people from the community spend much of their time outside of Nepal, specifically in areas of India, such as Darjeeling and Sikkim, and also in China's Tibetan Autonomous Region, which is just across the border, really only several miles as the crow flies from their villages in Nepal. So I became intrigued by trying to understand that part of the story. And also that began to answer some of the questions for me about why the group had been so mysteriously absent from the ethnographic record. And there are other reasons as well, but part of the answer was that they had invested so many of their resources into actually leaving the village. This created a different kind of profile than what many earlier anthropologists had been looking for in their choice of village studies in the region.
Well, it's a fascinating sort of call for you to come and do that research. So I suppose the best way to get into the argument of your book is to talk about ethnicity. It's there in the title, and you ask a question in the first chapter about ethnicity, which is a question that Tangmi ask themselves. It's like, is ethnicity like a river or like a rock? So, Zunni, could you pick this apart for us?
Well, obviously the short answer to that, it's not easy, never easy, but the short answer to that is that it's both at once. And this is really the core of the argument. I use those terms in part because there are many different Tangmi origin myths and shamanic recitations in which phrases and metaphors like this are used. I cite one of those at the very beginning of the book. It's the epigraph to the first chapter where the shamans chant, "We are solid like rocks and viscous like mud." So a kind of definition of themselves as a people as being, on the one hand, firm and solid and grounded, but on the other hand, fluid and malleable. And that's a theme that actually runs through much of the oral literature of the community. And I had this moment, which I also describe in the first chapter, of being in a conference in Kathmandu where ethnicity was being talked about in much the same terms. But there it was being set up as a kind of oppositional situation, that ethnicity could be either fluid. In this case, the metaphor used was by a sociologist was as a river, whereas it could also be seen as fixed and firm like a rock. But these two, never the twain shall meet, these two couldn't really coexist together. And in that moment of listening to that conference presentation, I thought, well, that's interesting, because these are precisely the kinds of metaphors that Tangmi themselves are using to describe their identity. And yet, in their worldview, these two principles are not opposed, but rather mutually possible and simultaneously existent. So I then go back in the book and connect that to some existing tropes in Himalayan anthropology, particularly the work of William Fisher, who wrote about the Takali community of Western Nepal, also using this metaphor of a rock and a river. Fisher talks about how identity is like a river in the sense that it changes over time. It flows between rocks and it changes the riverbed, and it's not fixed. And one can't actually look at the same river year after year and see it as precisely taking the same route, as materially the same thing. And yet we all know it's the same river, although its course has changed. And that's the metaphor that he uses to talk about identity and ethnicity for the Takali community. So I basically pick up on that and take it a step further to say, yes, well, you know, it's not really an oppositional framing between a constructivist or a primordialist viewpoint, to use the more traditional academic terms, but rather we should perhaps understand the recognition that ethnicity is constructed as the starting point, and then take off from there to try to understand what that means for people who live with that reality all the time. And I felt that it was time to kind of make this intervention, because much of the last wave of writing on ethnicity, both in Nepal, say, with authors like Fisher and others working elsewhere in South Asia and elsewhere in the world as well. And this is writing really in the kind of late 1990s and early 2000s, talks about the recognition that ethnicity is constructed as if that is sort of the endpoint. And therefore, we perhaps don't need further analysis of how ethnicity works. And in my own experience entering the field at a much later date than these other scholars whose work I build upon and respect greatly, my own experience was, well, wait a minute, we can't really stop there. It's essential to understand how, recognizing that ethnicity is constructed, it takes life and becomes a driving force in people's realities on the ground. And that's how I found that Pangmi themselves were engaging with the concept. They were very well aware of the constructedness of ethnicity as a category. It wasn't simply that they were acting in highly instrumentalized and kind of crass ways about this. However, they were thinking really creatively about, well, what do we do in a sense with this resource as a marginalized community who is angling for a different kind of recognition within the nation state, in fact, several nation states. And so what I found was a very active and self-reflexive and explicit discussion about these issues within the community. And that's what I seek to portray.
And what was really interesting, I found, was that not only are they self-aware, but they're also, there's a performative aspect to ethnicity, right? I mean, this is key, and this is something which they reflect on themselves.
Absolutely, yes. And the thing is, it's a wide range of different kinds of performances. And this is what I try to describe in the book as well, that there's not a singular way of being Pangmi or a singular set of practices and performances with which one must engage to be recognized by others as Pangmi. Rather, there's a wide range of different things one can do, and that ethnicity is actually a kind of collaborative production that requires several different kinds of people, diverse individuals, participating in diverse forms of action in order to be produced as a whole.
And this performance also, I mean, there's a really nice anecdote, I think, at the beginning of chapter two, when the Pangmi from Nepal are performing alongside Pangmi in Darjeeling in India, or at a stage function for a state, a state official in India. So it's really interesting how this performance shifts between different national contexts.
Absolutely, yes. And that's actually something which is tagged as a wedding dance as it's performed in that context. And the actual performance event that you mentioned was in India, and it was on a stage in a kind of highly scripted context. But it's a kind of dance that's actually done across the Pangmi community in very different kinds of environments. And so what I was able to see through that was that, and the argument that I make is that staged version of it is not a kind of inauthentic or derivative version, but rather a fully authentic version of a particular cultural form, which is reinterpreted and transposed into a different context, where historically those dances might have been performed inside a house in a domestic space late at night for the internal consumption of members of the Pangmi community, and also importantly for their deities. But in this context in India, the performance is turned outwards for consumption by representatives of the state. And yet I see those two as integrally linked. So I'm kind of trying to work against the notion that contemporary performatization of culture or ritualization of ritual, to use Richard Handler's term, is somehow to be seen as less authentic or as a fall from grace, but rather is productive in itself and feeds back into the production of what I call practice in the kind of community internal context that's performed for deities as well.
Wonderful, thank you. What came through very strongly was the importance of Tangmi's oral practices, both in the gurus and in the, it's there in the origin myths and so on. I was wondering, could you talk through the sort of centrality of orality in Tangmi culture?
Yes, thank you. That's a good question. So historically, the Tangmi language was not written. In fact, some of the first documentation of it has been done by Mark Turin, who I mentioned earlier. He's a linguist and anthropologist, and his book is a grammar of the Tangmi language. And that came out in 2012 and is one of the first times in which the language has been rendered in textual terms. And so this is a kind of, like many other languages, an oral tradition. And that actually, that orality is taken to be a central feature of Tangmi identity. Now, this is particularly the case in the practices of the Tangmi shamans, who are their key religious figures. And perhaps I should have mentioned earlier as well, as this is a question that I always get asked, that Tangmi are neither Hindu nor Buddhist, which are the two primary religious traditions that people will be familiar with in the Himalayan region. Rather, they practice their own religion, which they often call Tangmi Dharma or Tangmi religion, which relies upon shamans, whom they call gurus, as the central ritual officiants. And the shamans are basically masters of oral literature in the sense that they have memorized these long drawn out ritual recitations, which contain the origin myths of the Tangmi people and a whole range of stories, which are actually constitutive of Tangmi identity, that talk about how they came to be, where they are now, how they were constituted as a community, who their ancestors were, how their clans came into being. All of that information is transmitted orally. And so for the gurus themselves, the shamans, the practice of those ritual recitations, which are known as paloke, are actually a key component of the practice of identity. And so without those recitations, it's very difficult to reproduce and transmit Tangmi identity. So the gurus basically have become invested in, of course, maintaining this oral tradition. At the same time, for many younger members of the community, there's a real desire to textualize certain elements of the tradition, in part to make it more accessible to a wider range of people, to be able to circulate information amongst the broadly dispersed, geographically dispersed community, and so forth. So part of what I describe, and this is in chapter three, is a sort of tug of war that emerged between often, not always, but often younger members of the community who were involved in different forms of political activism and were advocating certain forms of textualization, and then older members of the community, often, although not always again, who were led by gurus or shamans who asserted that orality was central to maintaining Tangmi identity, and that if these traditions were textualized in a way, their authenticity would be damaged. But so I look at how this really power struggle played out over time and how the two groups basically found modes of accommodation to work with each other, because ultimately they both knew that they relied upon the other's form of production in order to survive. For the gurus, ultimately, they realized that without the kind of external support and in many cases funding that could come from being able to textualize and circulate forms of their ritual practice, they would not be able to continue. While at the same time, the activists also understood that without the gurus themselves, who are really the iconic figure of Tangmi identity and practice, their textual forms would have no sort of authentic referent to return to. So I look at how this kind of plays out over time. And also I look at how the different forms of visual media, in particular video, and more recently, actually, social media representations enable a sort of rapprochement between these different perspectives.
Thank you. I mean, it's been at the background of our discussion so far, this sort of movement between three different national contexts, between India, the Tibetan Autonomous Region in China, and Nepal. But you hone in really, really strongly in chapter four when you look at circular migration and how it creates, you know, what you call tangminess. So could you please tell us why circular migration is so important?
Yes, thanks. As you say, that's kind of the the kind of fundamental thing to understand about how this all works. Tangmi began migrating between Nepal and India in the colonial era, probably around the 1830s or so, when they were recruited as workers on the new plantations that the British were beginning to build in Darjeeling. Now, they were just a few of the many people from Nepal who went to work in Darjeeling. This is not only a Tangmi phenomena, but one of the things that does seem to be relatively unusual for the Tangmi themselves is that while other communities went to India from Nepal and then settled there, the Tangmi community had some people who settled, but some people who came back to Nepal and then have continued a process of circular migration until the present. And that's not too common amongst other communities in Nepal. So what you have is a situation where for Tangmi whose property, whose homesteads, homes literally, so to speak, are in these hill villages of rural central eastern Nepal, many members, or at least one or two members from each homestead, each family, will usually spend 3 to 6 months of the year in India. And what they'll be doing there is usually unskilled migrant labor, literally portering goods up and down the streets of Darjeeling's Hill Bazaar, which doesn't have a lot of motorable roads, doing construction work and other kinds of labor. And so they'll then earn enough money there simply to feed themselves and maybe have a bit extra. And then they'll come back home to Nepal for the planting seasons in which their agricultural labor is needed, planting and harvesting seasons. So they basically maintain this lifestyle in which there are homesteads in Nepal, but there's a site of labor in India, as well as kind of temporary homesteads that get set up there, to the extent that many Tangmi children spend some of their time in Nepali schools and some of their time in Indian schools. And many Tangmi who do participate in this circular migration route also have some sort of, at least the paper documents of citizenship from both countries, even though technically that's illegal. So they've basically set up this kind of livelihood strategy, which relies upon regular cross-border migration. And that's sort of what I argue is the premise for much of the different kind, many of the different kinds of ethnic production that I describe, precisely because you've got this community which is dispersed across borders. There is also a settled Tangmi community in India, people whose forebears went during the colonial era and stayed. And then you've got this group of people who are moving back and forth annually, who, beyond actually bringing back remittances or money earned through their labor, are also bringing back and forth ideas and transmitting notions about what culture is, how ethnicity should be performed, how to engage with the nation state, and so forth. So what I try to show is there's actually a fairly high level of exchange and discussion between India and Nepal in particular, and that the various experiences that people have with these different nation states and their different policies significantly impact the way that the community as a whole engages in the production of ethnicity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, were you going to?
Oh, I was just going to say one thing I didn't mention was what happens in the TAR, in the Tibetan Autonomous Region. And this doesn't feature so strongly in the book. Although my original project had been to do ethnographic research in all three countries equally, I did manage to get research permission in China, but only for a much shorter time period. So I wasn't able to include that material in the same way. I do have a few articles in which that dynamic is discussed. But many of the people who are moving back and forth between Nepal and India on a regular basis are also spending shorter periods of time in Tibet, the Tibetan Autonomous Region. They could go there and move across the northern border directly from their homesteads in Nepal without needing a passport or a visa due to the border treaties in place between Nepal and China. And they often found many prospects for short-term labor there. So that introduces a third country with a third set of policies and attitudes towards this ethnicity as well, which also figured prominently in the ways that people thought about themselves and their own orientations.
And another way that certainly helped construct the way people thought about their ethnic their ethnicity was certain organizations, Tangmi organizations. So I was wondering, could you tell us a little bit about what these organizations do and how they play into this construction of identity?
Yeah, thanks. And I think that's some of the material in the book, which I think may be of most interest to area specialists, including those who work in India, because as well as those who work in Nepal, because what's most interesting to me is that there's a very long historical trajectory of organizing around ethnicity within the Tangmi community. And that's not a fact that's always well known. Many of the more recent arguments about ethnicity in this region have tried to suggest that it's in fact a new concept, which doesn't have historical roots in the region, but in fact has been introduced more recently, particularly with the circulation of indigeneity discourse and discussions of indigenous rights, which really only emerged after the early 1990s. But what the historical material that I was able to access showed was that, in fact, there had been active organizations premised on the notion of a shared ethnic identity going back at least till the 1930s, if not earlier. So the first Tangmi organization was founded in India. They claim that its official date of founding was 1943, but there are photographs that show organized Tangmi meetings dating back to 1936, although the group didn't have a formal name and wasn't registered in any way until 1943. So that's really a long history there. And that organization, which has had several names over time, but is now called the Bharatiya Tangmi Welfare Association, or the Indian Tangmi Welfare Association, has created a site for diverse Tangmi to come together and basically work on shared projects. At some points in time, had primarily cultural agendas. For instance, it was founded in order to provide the framework for carrying out funerary rituals in the Indian context, where it was often hard for people to get both the material resources and also the labor resources that they needed in order to carry out traditional Tangmi funerary rituals. So that was a kind of cultural purpose, or what's often called a welfare purpose of the original organization. And then over time, it also took up political agendas, trying to found a Tangmi language school, for instance, and seeking funds from the state of West Bengal as well as the central Indian state. And more recently, they have been at the forefront, the organization has been at the forefront of trying to secure the status of scheduled tribe for Tangmi in India, which they don't currently hold. So that's really what the organization in India has been most focused on in recent decades. In Nepal, the central organization is called the Nepal Tangmi Samaj, and its predecessors date to the 1980s, which is when we find the first historical evidence of Tangmi organizations being formed in the rural areas where most Tangmi are based, notably in Dolaka district. And the interesting thing in the Nepali context is that the ethnic organizations have had a long and intertwined history with political party organization in rural Nepal. And I try to untangle some of that in chapter five. But suffice it to say that in Nepal in particular, there's been a sort of ongoing tension about whether marginalized communities can most effectively mobilize themselves on the basis of ethnicity or on the basis of class in relation to communist mobilization. Both Maoist Party, which people have heard about in more recent years, but also earlier, what are often called mainstream communist parties, such as the United Marxist-Leninists. So I try to untangle some of those histories there. And I also look at how these two organizations have communicated over time and shared information to try to create a transnational Tangmi community, even though both of them are also serving quite distinctive national constituencies.
Wonderful, thank you. We've talked a bit about movement between different countries, and what I found really fascinating that was for the Tangmi, even their deities move. So I was wondering, could you tell us a little bit about this and how this portability of deities intersects with the territorial claims that Tangmi want for an autonomous region for themselves?
Right, thanks. Yeah, this is some of the material in the book, which I think has the most relevance to some of the contemporary political debates over indigeneity and mobility, which are at the heart of some of Nepal's ongoing political issues, but which are also key to understanding, for instance, the Gorkhaland movement in Darjeeling, which is sort of the backdrop against which much of the Tangmi story plays out there. In the Tangmi origin myths, which I referred to a little bit earlier, that are recited by the gurus or shamans in their ritual recitations, we meet a couple who are the ancestral forebears of the Tangmi, who are called Yapati Chupu and Sunari Ama, or they have some other kind of variant names as well that you'll sometimes hear. This couple migrates up a set of intertwined river pathways from south of Dolaka, where the Tangmi currently reside, south of the hills. And the origin myth kind of tracks them wandering up through these river basins and coming to the area where they ultimately settle. And with them, they carry a deity known as Bume, which literally means the earth deity. That term Bume, of course, is not distinct or unique to the Tangmi, but is used across many South Asian languages and communities to describe territorial deities. But the Tangmi see their Bume as distinct precisely because it is the Bume or territorial deity that this ancestral couple brought with them when they settled in Nepal. So the central temple now for Tangmi ritual practice is located in Dolaka district in a place called Suspa. And that is where this deity is believed to have been installed by this ancestral couple when they first arrived in Dolaka. Now, that temple has actually grown from being a kind of open air site of worship where the Bume itself is personified by a black rock. And over time, it's been enclosed and had a temple built around it, which has actually now been destroyed in the recent earthquakes. But the deity still exists there. However, people are well aware that the deity only came at a certain historical moment, and it can also be replicated and brought with Tangmi wherever they go. So, in fact, there are many subsidiary Bume shrines across different Tangmi settlements in Nepal, which have been there for quite a long time, and where local communities can engage in their ritual practices without having to go to the central temple. So by the same token, when Tangmi migrated to India and also northwards to Tibet, they were actually able to bring the deity with them. So there are also Tangmi Bume shrines in India, in Darjeeling and Sikkim. And these shrines have to refer back to the central site at Suspa. And often people will bring rocks or soil from that central temple to the new temples in order to consecrate them and basically set them up within a territorial framework that joins all of these what would we call them, all of these manifestations of Bume. And so this portability means that it is really possible for a Tangmi to at once have a very strong connection to a particular locale, a particular place where that central Bume shrine stands, but also to see their own mobility as flexible because they're able to install their deity wherever they go. And so I argue in chapter 6 of the book that, in fact, this creates a different way of understanding and really thinking through the complexities of indigeneity, because it gives us a way of thinking about both emplacement and mobility within the same framework. So rather than needing to see these again as oppositional things, that one is either emplaced and has a strong commitment to a particular territory, or one is mobile and cosmopolitan, actually we can see these two dynamics of life as being connected within the way that Hangmi themselves think about their own mobility and their own relationship to place through territorial deities.
Wonderful, thank you. Now that we're on the topic of rituals proper, let's stick on that and let's talk a little bit about the marriage and funeral rituals. You argue these play a very important role in how the Tangri recognize themselves. So could you tell us a little bit about these important life cycle rituals?
Right. Well, as I mentioned already, the Tangri are neither Hindu nor Buddhist, but maintain their own religious practices. And so in order to do that, of course, they need key ritual events where everyone can come together. These ritual events take the form of life cycle rituals. Of course, every community has these, but I argue that for the Tangri, these are really central and key, both marriage and funerary rites in different ways. And this is because it's at these events that large groups of the community come together and, in fact, redefine each time what it is to be Tangri, recognize each other and all of their diversity as Tangri, and then basically reproduce those ideas and transmit them to the next generation. Now, the funerary ritual is really very interesting because I think that's the place in which kind of historical Tangri practice has been maintained to the present most successfully, in the sense that that ritual is carried out purely by Tangri's own officiants, the gurus. It's done exclusively in the Tangri language. And the whole ritual process itself relies upon a whole notion of reconstructing the body of the deceased out of a whole series of foodstuffs and naturally occurring products, which at the same time links that deceased body to place and basically creates that space, that place as Tangri territory. At the same time as it enables the soul of the deceased to move on. And also intriguingly, the Tangri notion of where that soul goes is to an underworld rather than to a heaven or some other kind of place. So there are really many features of the funerary rituals which are distinctive and which enable Tangri to really describe to themselves their uniqueness and to create a sense of a community which is separate from the others with whom they coexist. And Tangri funerary rites are also required to be carried out in sort of ethnically specific spaces. The marriage rituals have shifted much more over time and have been influenced by many what people would often call Hinduized elements in a way that's really interesting, because the marriage rituals in a sense form an important site of discussion and debate for members of the community themselves as they try to work out how they want to be Tangri going into the future, what elements of their past they think are most important to reproduce and carry on, but also how they want to be, in a sense, at what level they do want to be assimilated and understood to be part of a broader kind of regional sense of a kind of ritual world, which is recognizable to others. So in a sense, the marriage rituals are kind of more outward facing because they engage with other ritual elements that are in the Tangri environment, whereas funerary rituals tend to be more inward facing. But I argue that both of these are really essential and that one mustn't sort of discount the marriage rituals as being somehow Hinduized and therefore not Tangri or not relevant to understanding what Tangri are, because it's in fact in that site of contestation and discussion about these issues that kind of Tangri-ness comes to the fore. And it's also in the marriage rituals themselves in which people are assigned a Tangri clan. And that's a kind of key component of being Tangri at an individual level. I don't think I mentioned earlier that there are seven male clans and seven female clans. And this is one of the really interesting features of Tangri social structure, that they have seven of each gendered clans, altogether comprising a system of what's called parallel descent. This means that girls get their clan identity from their mothers and boys receive it from their fathers. So that's a different system than either patrilineal or matrilineal systems. And this is really quite unusual. It's only practiced by a kind of handful of communities around that world, around the world. And it's through the marriage rituals that these clan identities are passed on and confirmed. And then in funerary rituals that they're basically that they're brought together as a whole community, because in both of these rituals, you need, in theory, at least one member of each of the seven male clans and one member of each of the seven female clans to proceed.
Wonderful. And I remember in one part of the book, I'm sure probably in the last substantial chapter, when you said, when you were asking about what's the most important ritual element of Tangmi that I should look into, people often told you it was a particular ritual, this Devikot Khadga Jatri, if I pronounced that correctly. So I was wondering, Jatra. I've just made it into, said it in a Canada way, South Indian way. I'm sorry.
No worries.
Jatra. Yes. And so could you tell us a little bit about this and why it was so central?
Right. So this is, as you say, the final chapter of the book, and I use it to bring many of the themes together. It's actually two rituals, but they occur within the same calendrical time frame. So I talk about them together, Devikot and Khadga Jatra. And these occur during the period of Dasain, the fall harvest festival known as Dasera in many other parts of South Asia. In this ritual, historically, members, specifically designated members of the Tangmi community, had to come to the center of Dolaka Bazaar and participate in a ritual orchestrated by the Newar ethnic community and play basically a role of the kind of subjugated ritual bearer of ritual impurity. These two Tangmi men would have to come and in fact drink the blood of a live baby buffalo. So the buffalo's vein was pulled out of its neck and severed while it was still alive, and these men had to cup their hands and drink the blood from it. Now, you know, in a sense, this is very kind of viscerally effective, and the fact of that ritual action itself was a topic of much debate amongst members of the Tangmi community. And as you said already, when I would kind of early in my research ask quite open questions about what the most important Tangmi ritual was and so forth, everybody would point me towards this ritual. Of course, the intriguing thing is that this is a ritual in which the Tangmi seem to play this role of impurity and subjugation. So I was trying to understand what was going on there. Now, Father Caspar Miller, who was a Jesuit priest who conducted a great deal of wonderful ethnographic research across Nepal, wrote a book called Faith Healers of the Himalayas in the 1970s, in which he detailed this ritual among many others. And he basically made an argument that the Tangmi and the Newar had two different understandings of what was going on, and that the Tangmi were able to actually interpret the ritual within their own framework as being a ritual of power. And this seemed to kind of bear up amongst the discussions I had with Tangmi in Nepal, where people would tell me about how precisely because they played this key role in the Newar ritual, it enabled a certain sort of power for the Tangmi themselves vis-a-vis the Newar, who were the historical rulers and really dominant to the Tangmi in the region. So this seemed to make a lot of sense. But at the same time, there was a great debate about it. And there were many people who I might call reformers within the community, largely based in India and or younger members of the community in Nepal, who thought, no, this ritual is really something negative that we shouldn't do, because in a way we are basically agreeing to be bearers of impurity, and that's not something we want to do. So there was an ongoing and very active debate about this issue. Intriguingly, in India, some of the younger activists there who were seeking scheduled tribe status within the Indian national framework picked this ritual up as a positive thing, precisely because the quite antiquated criteria for scheduled tribe status in India, which still date to a 1965 report, include things like primitive traits and backwardness and geographical isolation and so forth. And these young activists in India thought that the sight of Pangmi drinking blood was actually very powerful for that purpose, because what could be more primitive, so to speak? So you can see how there are many different perspectives on the same ritual action. Now, of course, the problem for those activists in India, just as it was for other discussions about indigeneity, is that this ritual only takes place in Nepal. So how could they make an argument based on that for a certain status within the Indian national framework? And that's something that they had to struggle with. But ultimately, they seemed, this group that wanted to maintain the ritual in the face of others who were seeking to do away with Pangmi participation in it, the group that wanted to maintain the ritual seemed to triumph at a certain point in my research early on. And I actually wrote an article about this, which was published in 2005 in the European Bulletin of Himalayan Research, where I sort of took up this position that it was a ritual of power for the Pangmi. And although I wasn't engaged in making such a strong, let's say, political argument per se, I kind of myself wanted it to contribute to the agendas of those who were wanting to maintain the ritual, because that seemed to make sense to me. The thing that happened that really surprised me and shook me up was that the next year after that article was published in 2006, they actually suspended participation in the ritual. So it seemed to me that I had got it wrong, but also all these other members of the Pangmi community had got it wrong. And in the concluding chapter of the book, then I sort of use that as an opportunity to rethink and reflect on the whole process of research to try to understand what was actually happening and how it could be that things were actually so different to how they seemed to me. And what I end up suggesting at the conclusion of the book is that, in fact, the Pangmi ritual participation in the ritual did not end, and this is what I learned later, it simply became transposed once again into a new environment, just as we spoke earlier about certain kind of practice rituals, wedding rituals being transposed from the intimacy of a home to the public space of a stage. This ritual, in fact, had kind of gone the other direction, where it turned out the Pangmi men who had drunk the buffalo's blood were still being possessed by the goddess. I forgot to mention that earlier. They go into trance possessed by one of their own deities in order to basically have the power to drink the blood. They were still having that experience, but they were just going into trance in their own homes rather than coming to Dalaka Bazaar to participate in the Newar orchestrated ritual. So in a sense, they had sort of rescued and resuscitated the indigenous rich aspect of the ritual and reframed it within their own home context. Now, when I asked several people who were deeply involved in the practice of this ritual why this had happened at this particular historical junction, the first answers that I got were that, well, the Maoists, political activists, had asked us to stop, and so we felt that we had to stop. But this didn't really make full sense to me, because, in fact, there had been many Maoist requests for this and other things in the past, which nobody seemed to pay much heed to. And when I pushed a little bit further, basically, it turned out that people were feeling in 2006, after the time of the Second People's Movement in Nepal, when the king was ousted, the Shah dynasty was deposed. And at that time, there seemed to be a entirely new horizon opening up for a future, more inclusive state of Nepal. But many people in the Pangmi community felt, okay, we don't really need this anymore. We don't really need to show ourselves to be subservient to the Newar and assert power in this kind of way. Now we have our own modes of asserting political power, say through organizations like the Nepal Pangmi Samaj, and we're able to reframe this ritual in a different way, which is more effective for us personally. And so that's really the argument that I end up making at the end of the book, that the Pangmi ritual practice and therefore Pangmi modes of producing ethnicity is, of course, always shifting over time, returning to the ideas that we talked about in the beginning. But certain elements of it remain constant, and those are sort of the rocks that Pangmi individuals can base their own sense of identity around. However, the ways in which those rocks or those kind of features of the practice of ethnicity work may be very different in particular historical and political conjunctures.
It's absolutely fascinating. I'd just like to, I suppose, mention for the listeners who've not yet had the chance to read the book, there are so many really wonderful anecdotes in the book that stuck in my mind after reading it, from like activists trying to urge people to eat rats to these amazing stories of subterranean hotels in Darjeeling and so on. But I'm wondering if there's anything that you think that I've missed with my questions that you'd like to highlight.
Not really. I think you've done a wonderful and thorough job. You kind of helped me talk through the whole book. There is a lot in there, mm-hmm. and I hope people will dig into it themselves and will find things that we haven't mentioned here. I mean, the one thing that I would like to talk a little bit about is what's happened since the book, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Because the kind of really challenging thing for me this year has been that the book was released in March 2015, and then, of course, in April and May 2015, Nepal experienced two very severe earthquakes, the heart of which, at least the second earthquake, was smack in the middle of the Thangmi heartland. So it was a very challenging year for everybody who is described in the book, particularly those who live in Nepal, and also for me secondarily, as I tried to understand what would happen, and also try to work out how the book might in some way be useful or helpful to people as they work to rebuild their communities. Because I think, well, let me just take a step back for a second. One thing that we haven't really talked about is the book's framing as an ethnography, which is intended to be useful to the community themselves, as well as to scholars. And that's really a commitment that runs through the book. In a sense, the book is a symbolic form. It's that ethnography that the Thangmi were missing, as we discussed at the beginning. And although there may be issues that I know certain members of the community have with the way I've represented certain details or facts, overall, I think as a symbolic form, the book is useful because it's something that can be present, that they can present in different contexts to sort of assert their own presence. And this is in a context where ethnography has historically been very important to ethnic claims, both within Nepal and India, both for state purposes and also for NGO purposes and so forth. So that's always been my intention with the book. And the earthquakes then, of course, radically changed the situation. So suddenly it was not so much these campaigns around ethnic recognition, which were consuming people, but very material needs about how to survive in a context where basically every household was destroyed, every school, every community building across the entire Thangmi heartland area in Dolakha and Sindhupalchok districts. And I myself felt very... very perplexed and somewhat troubled by this, that I had just written this book, which in fact is quite expensive in its initial hardback copy and doesn't now seem to contribute to the immediate agendas of the people with whom I work in the way that I hoped I would, because those agendas were changed overnight by the earthquake. So that's something I've been working with. And some of the things that I did decide to do were to make a commitment to donating any royalties that the book ever makes, if any, to ongoing Thangmi efforts to reconstruct various parts of their earthquake destroyed livelihoods. So that commitment is there. And I also held a book launch in Nepal in was it August? Yes, at which I was able to sell the book for a discounted local rate. And all of those funds were contributed to the Nepal Thami Samaj's fund to support Thangmi families who had lost members in the earthquake. And there are about 50 families who have suffered in that way. So that's been very important. It's also been really interesting to try to consider how the earthquakes will change the situation that I describe, particularly because Thangmi houses, which are really a strong anchor for identity that I talk about throughout the book, are no longer really there. And it's unclear still how it will be rebuilt. Also, the political situation in the wake of the earthquakes with the promulgation of a new constitution in September of this year has also created a new set of challenges. And sadly, it doesn't look like that new inclusive Nepal, which people were so hopeful about in 2006, as I talk about at the end of the book, that hasn't really come to pass. And there are a lot of challenges ahead still regarding the constitution and the ongoing unrest that it's unleashed. And so I, as always, you know, I feel like the book kind of documents a certain period between about 1998 and 2008. But of course, it stops there, and it will be very interesting and important to understand what happens next.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, talking a bit about the future. So now that you mentioned this book came out in March, what are you currently working on, or what are your future plans?
Well, I've had a couple of different projects in the last few years, but the main one has actually been an ethnography of the state restructuring process in Nepal since 2006, which is when the formal comprehensive peace agreement was made that ended the 10-year-long civil conflict between the Maoists and state forces. And so about 2013, late 2013, I have been working on a project which was called Restructuring Life, Citizenship, Territory, and Religiosity in Nepal's State of Transformation. And to that end, the idea was really to try to understand from the outside in how Nepal was actually changing as it went through this process of quite literally restructuring the state in terms of its administrative form, but also how local people themselves had experienced those shifts in their own sense of political consciousness as political actors and agents. So for this project, I wanted to build upon the in-depth work with the Thangmi that appears in the book, but also go beyond it to try to understand Nepal as a whole. Of course, that's never really possible. But from my own way of doing this was to choose research sites in three districts, one of which is Dolaka, another one of which is Mustang, which is in the northwest Himalayan part of the country. And that's another area where I had actually worked earlier, prior to beginning my work with the Thangmi. And then I also selected a new research site in Bangke, which is in the western Terai, along the border with India. And so working with a research team of five Nepali researchers, we constructed a kind of in-depth ethnographic survey that addressed these issues of how people experience citizenship, territory, and religiosity during this process of transformation that Nepal has experienced since 2006, conducted over 150 interviews. And I'm in the process of basically trying to understand and analyze all of that. It's quite revealing material. Now, that was ongoing at the time of the earthquake, which quite literally shook everything up for us because we could no longer continue working in the way that we were before. And the ground reality and context, political context, also changed so radically very quickly that the questions no longer seemed relevant. So I'm still trying to work out what exactly to do with that and how to go forward next. And I'm looking at different ways of connecting up that pre-earthquake material that does in fact speak to many of the ongoing political issues now, with a closer look at some of the post-earthquake political dynamics. So that's one of the main projects I'm engaged in. I'm also wanting to conduct new research in India and continue inquiries there. One of the things that I am working on with another colleague, Townsend Middleton, who also works in Darjeeling, is an edited volume which looks at dynamics of history, politics, and environment in Darjeeling. And so that's a project that we've just recently undertaken.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. They both sound like fascinating projects, and we look forward to being able to read the fruits of those sometime in the future. But for now, it's the end of our discussion. I'd like to thank you again for coming on the podcast. I really enjoyed the book. I'd like to recommend it to everyone listening. It's really not just is it fascinating, as I hope people have heard, but also it's a really wonderful read. So thanks a lot for coming on.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook, and today we've been talking about Rituals of Ethnicity by Sarah Schneiderman. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation today with Sarah, and I hope you're tempted to go and read the book for yourselves. Ta-ra!